Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. My name's Carl Shinneman, Director of Analytics and Review with Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it or downloading it, putting it on an iPod, on a computer. Basically, time's sort of irrelevant with these, just when you have time. Today we have a great show, and I'm pleased this is the last show we're going to record in 2009. It's a great topic and great speakers. We have the Honorable Andrew Peck from the Southern District of New York, Maura Grossman, who's an e-discovery attorney with the law firm of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz based in New York, which is primarily a defense-oriented law firm, and Bill Butterfield from the law firm of Hausfeld LLP, which is primarily a plaintiff-oriented law firm. And collectively, we're going to talk about why, from each of these different stakeholders' perspective, more cooperation in e-discovery can work for all parties and should be used more. Briefly, each participant's background. The Honorable Andrew Peck was appointed United States Magistrate Judge for the Southern District of New York in 1995, and served as Chief Magistrate Judge in 2004 and 2005. He served as a law clerk to Judge Paul Ronne of the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th, which was then the Fifth Circuit during the 1977-78 term. Previously, Judge Peck was an associate and counsel at the firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. His practice in commercial litigation emphasized entertainment and intellectual property litigation, as well as arbitration. Judge Peck is also an adjunct professor at Cardozo Law School, where he teaches a course in pretrial practice. He received an AB from Cornell University and a JD from Duke University School of Law. Two of his notable e-discovery decisions include the groundbreaking decision in Anti-Monopoly Inc. versus Hasbro Inc., 1995 WL649934 in the Southern District, New York, 1995, and more recently, William A. Gross Construction Associates, Inc. versus American Manufacturers Mutual Insurance Company, which can be found at 256 Federal FRD 134, Southern District, New York, 2009. Both these cases provide great instruction on framing search terms. Judge Peck is frequently speaking nationally and internationally on e-discovery and is a member of the Sedona Conference Advisory Board. He's also been a frequent advocate of better cooperation between parties in electronic discovery. Maura Grossman is counsel with the prominent New York-based business law firm Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz. She currently focuses her practice on advising lawyers and clients on legal, technical, and strategic issues involving electronic discovery and information management, both domestically and abroad, as well as on matters of legal ethics. Maura speaks and writes frequently on electronic discovery and legal ethics. She's a member of the Sedona Conference Working Groups on Best Practices for Electronic Document Retention and Production, and on International Electronic Information Management Discovery and Disclosure. She assisted in drafting and editing the Sedona Conference Commentary on Achieving Quality in the e-discovery process, May 9, 2009, the public comment version, which is an outstanding document. I recommend everyone to review that, and she also serves on the advisory board of BNA's Digital Discovery and E-Evidence Report, who I used to do audio broadcasts for, and they're a great source of material. She's involved in various initiatives to provide training on electronic discovery to state court judges and court-appointed special masters and mediators. This is an interesting thing that you do, Maura. She's the coordinator of the 2010 legal track of the National Institute of Standards and Technology's Text Retrieval Conference, known in the industry as TREC, which is a joint government industry academic research project studying the application of automated information retrieval technologies to the growing challenge of e-discovery, or in other words, how to search for stuff better. Bill Butterfield, the last participant here, is a partner with Hausfeld LLP, which is a global claimant law firm, and he's also recognized as a leader in the field of e-discovery. Bill has developed electronic document management solutions since the early 1990s when he helped design and led the implementation of an electronic document repository to manage more than 15 million pages of documents produced in the In Re Prudential Securities Limited Partnerships litigation. That system was recognized by senior U.S. District Judge Milton Pollack as one of the most innovative and sophisticated high-tech document management litigation support systems available. That's actually cited at 163 FRD 200 at page 208. That's in the Southern District of New York, 1995. In 2005, he testified before the U.S. Judicial Conference's Rules Committee's, Committee regarding proposed electronic discovery amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Bill also speaks at conferences internationally in electronic discovery and is also a member of the Sedona Conference. Great panel. First of all, I'd like to go around the group, starting with you, Maura, first. How did you get first interested in electronic discovery?
Actually, e-discovery came to me. Over the years as a litigator, I'd been involved in numerous large document productions, both on behalf of our clients and for the firm. And about 3 years ago, my mentor at Wachtell came to me and said he thought this electronic discovery stuff was going to become a very big deal. And he suggested that I get my arms around it and develop some expertise in the area. So somewhat reluctantly, I'll admit, I went out to Memphis to attend a Sedona conference program. And I came back among the converted, convinced that the sky was falling. When I returned to New York, I decided at that point I was going to learn everything I possibly could about this area. And I've never looked back. Now eDiscovery is a full-time job.
Okay, and Bill?
Well, you mentioned the case I was involved in when I first became interested in the field. It was in the early 90s, and I had a huge securities case I was working on involving more than 700 limited partnerships. And we, you know, these were the days where you went and did paper productions, and we went to the basement of Cahill Gordon, and I had a team coding paper documents for probably the better part of a year. But we had so many documents that we were working with that we decided we had to do something a little more innovative than had been done before that time. So we did the very forward-thinking thing at the time, which was to TIFF image the documents, and we developed this was before the internet, but we developed a hosting solution whereby lawyers could access the documents using thin client servers. I had lawyers in six different cities accessing the documents with dedicated servers and coding the documents, sort of the old-fashioned, way. But we actually managed to do this litigation, do this discovery with 15 million pages of documents in that case and get through it because we innovated. And ever since that, I've been interested in the field and have become more and more engrossed in it, although I still practice antitrust law in my day job, but I do a lot of e-discovery work for clients and on big antitrust cases.
Judge Peck, yourself?
Believe it or not, way back when in the dark ages, I was a computer minor in undergraduate at a time when we punched everything into punch cards and batched them into the mainframe computer. But I quickly got out of that, and anti-monopoly in 95 was really my first re-look into this area, and at that point I said in that decision that something to the effect of, quote, it is by now black-letter law that computerized information is discoverable. I think other than that quote, the opinion has no further relevance nowadays. But then when what became the December 2006 rules amendments were being circulated, I started looking at them and gave a talk to an American Bar Association group and to the New York City Bar. And I think with the internet and Google and everything else, after having given two speeches on it, other people thought I must be an expert on the area and started asking me to speak more. And since I enjoyed it, I've kept up with the area and do like to speak on it. And of course, it is an important part of my day job because nowadays, basically all discovery in federal court is electronic discovery.
See, everyone started in the punch card stage of e-discovery, it sounds like. We've all evolved. Now we're at the we're people are saying we have to be, which is more cooperation, because the other models don't seem to work very well, being more adversarial. So, you know, we've got different stakeholders here in the process. Someone primarily defendant, someone primarily a plaintiff or claimant, and a judge, all talking about cooperation. Why do you each want this? You know, what's the business case for doing this? Maureen, if you want to start off.
Maura,
sorry.
It's okay. As defense counsel, I'm a proponent of cooperation for several reasons. First, well, I'm not exclusively the producing party, and in most situations I'm the producing party, and or I'm representing the producing party. And if I don't cooperate and I can't get the requesting party to trust me and to act reasonably, my client loses, because I'm not only going to drive up my client's costs when my opponent insists on production of everything under the sun and a pony, but also if I don't cooperate and I'm not reasonable, I only increase the likelihood that my opponent is going to look for opportunities to seek sanctions. We all know that accidents happen in e-discovery, and if I've established a relationship of trust and fair dealing, when those errors happen, they're far less likely to mushroom into something antagonistic, some kind of dispute that makes the litigation move away from the merits to some expensive, time-consuming battle over peripheral matter.
Bill, you're oftentimes on the other end. Why do you see cooperation being helpful?
Well, it's helpful for a number of reasons. And as the requesting party, I'm interested in sort of getting my documents and information produced as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And it's a godsend to be able to sit in a room with opposing counsel and to have a discussion about things that in the not-too-distant past I had to get this information through interrogatories or 30B6 depositions. Now we can sit in a room and exchange information, and we generally arrive at the same point, but a lot more quickly and with far less expense. Also, my firm represents some very large companies, and obviously when we are on the producing part in litigation, and as a producing party, I have the same interests as Maura does, and that's saving my client money and saving them aggravation. So I think it's helpful to both sides.
And Judge Beck, you're oftentimes in the middle or telling people they got to cooperate more. What do you see from looking at both sides there?
I am indeed a big advocate for cooperation. I'm one of the 100 or so judges that have signed on to the Sedona Cooperation Proclamation. And from a judicial standpoint, it really goes back to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 1 that says the rules should be construed and administered to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action and proceeding. And with the amount of digital information out there, and particularly because of the way people store it on their computer, which often is somewhat random. In the old days, when I was in private practice, if there was a document request, we went to the key players and or their secretaries or administrative assistant and said, you know, show me the file or files in the file cabinet where you have the documents relevant to this litigation. Now, there may be some paper documents, but everything is going to be in email or other forms of electronic storage, Word documents, WordPerfect, Excel spreadsheets, whatever it may be. And they're not always well organized, to put it mildly. And when parties still use the old form of document requests, produce all documents about or concerning X, the fact of the matter is, and Maura can talk about this more, the Trek legal studies show that searching turns up maybe 25% of the relevant information, no matter how good a search you use, whether it's brunt force, you know, manual labor, a ton of paralegals and young lawyers looking at every electronic document, whether it's keyword searching, whether it's more advanced search techniques, you're not going to produce everything. And if you're not open and cooperating and transparent with the other side, in most cases, they are going to have an email or other form of ESI that you didn't produce that is responsive to their document request. And that's when the skepticism and the aha, you know, you must be hiding the smoking gun starts coming out, and the, you know, the fumes start coming out of the lawyers' ears as they accuse each other of bad faith. And that gets dumped in my lap. And to me, cooperation, transparency, and that sort of thing is like buying an insurance policy for the lawyers. If you're telling the other side what you are going to do, so maybe it's, you know, we have decided there are five key players and we're going to go and search their electronic files and not the 500 other employees in the company that theoretically might have something but probably don't. And we're going to use the following search technique or the following keywords, and having a dialogue with the other side. And, you know, that doesn't mean that if parties are cooperating with each other, they won't have different views on the scope of production. But at least if they're being open and transparent, they can discuss it and either use, we'll start with the five key players, but without waiving the other side's ability to go back for more, or they'll bring the dispute to me. And if a dispute is brought to me early in a litigation, it can be resolved without excessive cost to the parties or delay. If the parties are playing ostrich and neither one is talking to each other, you tend to get those disputes in the form of a spoliation motion very late in the case, either at the close of discovery or, as in the Qualcomm case, during the trial. And at that point, there is not much a judge can do other than impose sanctions.
Judge Peck, you mentioned the cooperation proclamation. I was just talking to a federal judge in Western Pennsylvania who made an observation that she'll sit at the meet and confer, or she'll talk to the parties that say we've agreed we're not going to look at ESI, and she says, are you sure?
Yeah, you know, I think there was a lot more of that, what I call the Cold War approach to it by lawyers. It's mutually assured destruction. If I ask you for ESI, you'll ask me. Frankly, neither of us know what the heck that is all about. Let's just ignore it. Lawyers cannot do that anymore, and that one of the ethical considerations in all this, it's another C that goes with cooperation, and that is competency. And lawyers need to understand enough about their clients' computerized and record-keeping systems to know how to handle this, and they can't just ignore it, or certainly not without their clients' advice and consent, because basically nothing is paper anymore. So it is important, crucial for lawyers today to be knowledgeable, or if they're not, to go to someone at their firm like Moore or Bill, or go to an outside law firm and get somebody to be co-counsel to handle the electronic discovery. You can't just ignore it anymore. And indeed, you know, we are seeing not quite we won't do e-discovery, but at the 26F conference, what I and some other judges call, you know, the drive-by approach to it. They know they have to talk about the ESI, electronic discovery, so they agree that they will, if asked by the other side, produce electronic documents, and that's as far as their discussion goes, because they don't know how to do it the right way.
Well, let's talk about the not knowing how to do it the right way. And often on a podcast, I hear many of these concepts we cover with experts like yourselves on the show. It sounds easy when you deal with the educated participant. What do you do when you face off against an uninformed e-discovery participant? How do you educate them on this principle, since it seems so counterintuitive to litigants who thrive on confrontation? And Bill Moore, if you want to jump in on this, you send them Sedona pamphlets, carrots and sticks.
I can start on this one. It's really pretty simple. It comes down to coming to the meet and confer prepared, armed with information, and ready to have a meaningful dialogue. You have to know your case, and you have to know your client's information systems. You know, who are your key custodians? What's the relevant time frame? How did those custodians communicate? Where's the most relevant ESI likely to be located? What's not reasonably accessible and why? You have to be reasonable in what you request and what you're going to object to. And you have to be willing to be open-minded and creative about things like privilege logging, shared databases, things like that that in the past you didn't even really discuss. You know, I think it's perfectly fine to send your opponent something like the Cooperation Proclamation or a case like Mancia or Judge Peck's case. And in fact, in the past, I've often sent opposing counsel cases where, for example, they flat out refused to produce spreadsheets in native format or something like that, and I wanted to show them that that position wasn't tenable. But, you know, basically I think what it boils down to is I think it was Gandhi who once said, we must be the change that we wish to see in the world. And it really makes a huge difference how you first come out of the box at the initial meet and confer. And if you're overly aggressive, you push back completely unreasonably on somebody else's reasonable demands, you're going to be met by resistance. And, you know, my experience has been unless someone's a real jerk, it's kind of difficult for them to continue to be unreasonable if you refuse to escalate and you continue to be fair and reasonable. And if they do, you start to maintain a record of your good behavior, your reasonableness, your efforts to compromise. And then if you need to go for relief, you go to the court early, as Judge Peck said, and you ask for some help.
Congratulations, Maura. You're the first person to cite Gandhi on this podcast of ESI Bites. So, Bill, from your perspective, I mean, you know, what happens when you get into a case and you're working with someone on the other side that also doesn't get it or hasn't experienced it yet?
Or on my side as well. But I'll start with the other side. What typically happens, and I do much like Maura, but I before a 26F conference, I usually send a detailed agenda to the other side. So I set expectations as to all of the topics I want to discuss, and that's also a way for me to gauge whether or not I'm dealing with someone who's knowledgeable in the area and whether or not I'm going to get resistance on these issues. So I try to start sort of setting the groundwork from that point and making a record if I'm dealing with someone who is not going to be reasonable. But I often get into a case where initially I'm dealing with very senior partners on the other side, and for the most part, they're not knowledgeable about this area, and they're very resistant to talking about this. And about a week later, I typically get a call from someone I know, usually a Sedona colleague, and that person says, you know, I've just been asked to get into the case. And then things get easier. So I haven't had too many situations where I'm dealing with counsel who remain in that aspect of the case who are not knowledgeable in the area. I have a situation actually right now in a piece of litigation where I may have that situation, and the other side has indicated that they want discovery completed within something like 12. This is a big antitrust case, and they want discovery completed within 12 weeks after it opens. So obviously they have no concept of any of these issues because typically it takes longer than that to work these issues out, let alone get production of documents and review them. A lot of the problems I get, frankly, are from my own side, and I'm dealing with co-counsel who are often senior people and not used to doing things this way, and they want to do things the old-fashioned way, and they're worried about expense, and they're worried about the time it takes to negotiate all of these issues, and it takes a lot of time to do that. So a lot of my work is sort of trying to turn them around, get them to understand why we're doing it this way, why it's necessary, why the time is well spent, because the time you spend up front is going to be saved 3 or 4 times down the line after production if you can avoid mistakes.
You know, it almost seems like there should be there are Hallmark cards for every holiday and occasion. Why can't there be one for the beginning of the meet and confer, you know? Judge Peck, when you get involved, if people aren't working together and cooperating, is there anything that you can do to help get people seeing things work better if they're working with each other?
I mean, one of the things I do is in my individual rules of practice, in addition to the usual things about, you know, timing and how they get extensions and all of that, I've put a note at the end of it that says I'm a big believer in the Sedona Cooperation Proclamation. So assuming they read my rules, which is not necessarily true of all lawyers, but shame on them, you know, they know walking right in that I expect cooperation. And generally, when I have early conferences, and I do tend to conference my cases regularly, I'll make sure at the beginning that I've suggested that they cooperate. And sometimes, either in court or at conferences, lawyers will say, you know, I'd like to cooperate, but my client wants a real lawyer, so they want me to fight everything. And, you know, the truth of the matter is when you then talk to the in-house counsel or the business people at the client, you know, they say, gee, we're spending so much money on litigation, I wish we could find ways to save money. So it really is, you know, an educational process that we're all going through here. And it's not just the Sedona conference and those of us who have adopted it that are suggesting to lawyers the need for cooperation. The Seventh Circuit has just introduced an electronic discovery pilot program for all courts in that district, and it basically reads just like the Sedona Cooperation Proclamation, requires the parties to discuss all of these issues, to have a point person to be the one talking about ESI issues, et cetera, et cetera. So the word is getting out there. And, you know, quite frankly, the unfortunate thing is, and you referred before to this, you know, carrot and stick concept, the lawyer or party that is not cooperating is much more likely to wind up facing sanctions, even if it's just attorney's fees for the other side in making various discovery or spoliation motions. And frankly, we'd like to avoid that.
You know, now that the cooperation proclamation's been out there for a while, Mancy has been out there for a while, people have experience trying to cooperate. And I was hoping that maybe we could share a best case sort of in the abstract, what were the benefits of cooperating if you have that type of a situation that you can share? More on Bill?
Sure. I can think of several. On more than one occasion, you know, witnesses have appeared for deposition preparation with documents or ESI that they didn't previously produce that should have been produced, and probably many people have experienced that. And if you have a history of a poor relationship with your adversary and you've been uncooperative and you've dragged your feet in the past, then this is likely to snowball and to result in a real problem, and you may find yourself in front of, for example, Judge Peck. But if you've had a good working relationship, you pick up the phone, you explain the issue, and it really doesn't become an insurmountable obstacle. Another example with regulators, if you have a good relationship, you can often convince them to stage the discovery, which will save your client considerable amount of money and heartache, which we talked about before, because sometimes you never get to the overly broad requests that are way out in the perimeter because they're satisfied with what they've got, you know, at the start. And then a final example is I was once able to convince an adversary to drop his challenges to a privilege log. We had developed a very productive working relationship in the course of the litigation, and I was able to make a proffer to him about, you know, what was there, that there was nothing of particular relevance to the issues that were in dispute, and we avoided a lot of time and money and wasted effort that would have been spent going through extraordinarily detailed logging to justify the privilege calls. And, you know, had I not had a good relationship, I don't think I could ever have gotten that result.
Bill, do you have any examples you want to share?
Yeah, I have a couple. And you know, I've had the good fortune recently to be on the other side of the table from many of my Sedona colleagues, and actually the federal magistrate judge in this case was also a Sedona colleague. So we sort of used it as sort of a test case for how much we can cooperate and how what kinds of things can we undertake to save clients money and to save time for everybody. And in that case, we worked on a solution to a privilege problem, and the solution we arrived at, and there's still a lot of resistance among parties to use Rule 502, but what we did was we entered into a solution whereby we used certain terms as filters, sort of as red flags that would probably indicate the existence of a privilege document. So where we had custodians who were outside counsel or inside counsel, and where certain terms arose in documents, like attorney within so many words of privilege, we sort of put them in a bucket and called them presumptively privileged. And so that the actual manual privilege review did not take place with respect to those types of documents. And with respect to the bucketed documents, we used sort of a metadata privilege log. So it was an automatic privilege log, and the requesting party had the right to look at that log and ask for a manual privilege review to be done where there were certain suspicions that a document might not have been privileged. That ended up saving clients hundreds of thousands of dollars. And for my part, it ended up getting me documents produced that much sooner. So all sides won. In another case that I'm working on right now, we are trying to address, there's been a lot of criticism in the case law recently about keyword searching, and Moore is well aware of as a Judge Pack, aware of the sort of problems associated with keyword searching. So I'm working with the other side again in a case where we are trying to develop protocols that will index, do a complete word index of documents and sort of use a sort of a higher level of sophistication in choosing keywords in a case. And we're working on that now. We'll see if we come up with something. But again, counsel in these cases are actually working together to try to achieve solutions to save their clients a lot of money. And, you know, a lot of people sort of misunderstand what is meant by cooperation. And cooperation doesn't mean you always agree with the other side. We fight about a lot of things, but where we can, we try to not fight about things where it's not necessary to fight, and where we can, we try to achieve solutions that will benefit all parties.
Well, those are great examples. I had a really nice podcast with Judge Fatriola on privilege logs, and he was calling out for that type of innovation that you just pointed to.
In fact,
great example.
Carl, in fact, he and Jonathan Redgrave, who's also very involved in Sedona, just wrote a law review article in the Federal Courts Law Review, available only online, dealing with methods to reduce the cost of preparing the privilege log, because quite frankly, the traditional privilege log, particularly where you have to deal with email chains, and do you log every email in the chain, do you log them as a collective, et cetera, results in a tremendous amount of make work and very little ability for the court in looking at it to use the privilege log to determine if something is privileged or not without actually looking at all the documents, which, as I typically tell litigants, while it is true that federal judges are now paid less than first-year associates at the big firms, it does not mean that I wish to do a massive document review. I did that when I was a junior associate. I'm not doing it anymore.
And Judge, I'm not sure if you, I mean, if there's a best experience where cooperating is working, that's got to be a lot easier for you. Are you seeing those types of situations?
I'm seeing lawyers cooperating. I'm seeing them trying to cooperate and not quite getting it right, including one multi-party case where, you know, I told them up front about my belief in cooperation and sent them off for a further meet and confer. And I should note that while Rule 26F refers to a single meet and confer process, it really has to be iterative and repetitive because you learn more and more as the case goes on. But I sat them, you know, had them sit down and go through it some more, and they agreed on using best commercial practices or something like that in the method of producing the documents. Unfortunately, each of their vendors had a slightly different view on what that meant in terms of native or quasi-native single-page format or page breaks. So they wound up having to do it again to a certain extent. And frankly, you know, most of what I war stories I would have on cooperation would come from listening to other lawyers like Bill and Maura, because the good news is, if parties cooperate, I don't see it. I don't, you know, I see the result, which is that they're not coming before me and spending a lot of money on discovery applications. But if they're getting along and producing things without problems, I won't necessarily see the solutions they've used to get there.
Well, we've talked about some of the successes, which are very impressive. You know, a lot of people react to pain better. Any worse experiences that highlighted the better need for cooperation, maybe cases you handled pre-cooperation principles coming out? Bill and Maura, if you want to chime in on that.
Sure. I had a somewhat recent case where I'll confess I thought we took a perhaps overly aggressive stance regarding the number of custodians we were willing to search. It was a very, very narrow group. And I think coming out of the box, we were seen as unreasonable, and we never really recovered from that. The discovery was permeated with distrust, you know, unwillingness to negotiate, insistence on forensic rather than logical collection, and then it kind of went downhill from there. And, you know, ultimately, I think I regretted that initial stance that was perhaps too aggressive and set the train on the wrong track.
And Bill?
I'm just going to interrupt to say that's very refreshing, because usually when parties talk about worst experience, it's the you know, the other guy who's the bad guy.
Well, they were the bad guy, but I think we may have had some peace in that.
Yeah, I my own experiences, I've been fairly fortunate when I get involved in cases, usually maybe the other side finds out something about me, and usually I see someone on the other side very soon thereafter who sets a more productive tone. Where I've noticed some problems, and I'd be interested in Judge Peck's view of this, but there are certain courts that have adopted local rules, and they're very proud of their local rules on e-discovery, and they're horrible local rules. Because they were written maybe 5 years ago, they're hopelessly outdated, and they confine parties and they sort of make a mess of things. So that's where I'm seeing some problems, where certain or I get a judge sometimes who just doesn't understand it, doesn't want to understand it, and horrible decisions get made, frankly. And I would be very interested in hearing what Judge Peck thinks about it, but I would love to see more knowledgeable judges like Judge Peck, and, you know, that would make life easier as well.
You know, I would love to say that all judges, or at least all federal judges, get it and know this area, but, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you look at the published e-discovery opinions, with one or two exceptions, like District Judge Shira Shinlin from my district, who wrote the Zubelake opinions, most of the opinions out there are from the magistrate judges. We are on the front lines on discovery, and particularly e-discovery. Most many judges, you know, came on the bench before they had to engage in e-discovery, either because they were senior enough that they did no discovery or because they've been on the bench long enough that we were all dealing in the paper world. So it is very important for advocates to know their judge. And because technology changes so much in this area, as Bill was referring to, it's important even with those of us who think we know what we're doing for the parties to educate us, because, you know, you could take as an example metadata. When Sedona first dealt with metadata in, well, 2005, I think it was, their presumption was that metadata need not be produced. Now Sedona has changed its view, and decisions such as Frank Moss's Aguilar decision in the Southern District in New York, you know, clearly show that appropriate metadata needs to be produced. When Judge Shindlin talked about backup tapes in Zubelake, there was a certain cost associated with recovering data from backup tapes. Now that cost has come down significantly. So in all cases, it's important for counsel to educate the judge. And with all due respect to my colleagues on the phone and the lawyers out there listening to this, at discovery conferences, I tend to take with somewhat a grain of salt what something that's said, if it's said by a lawyer. You really need to have an affidavit or the appropriate appearance or testimony from the IT people at the client or an outside IT professional, because the discussions between lawyers and IT professionals is somewhat like what Winston Churchill said about the British and American being separated by a common language. There is a disconnect between what lawyers hear and what the IT people are saying. So I would advise the audience to, if you're having a discovery conference in front of the court, bring the appropriate professional to back up the lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges you pointed out with the change in metadata approaches, you mentioned backup tapes. We did a podcast last week with Craig Ball and Quinn Greger and Jim McGann and pointed out how the technology's changed dramatically. So this old draw the line in the sand, we're not going there, for an older case might not make any sense. So you got to be very flexible, I guess, in this whole area.
Yeah.
Metadata for me, there are some decisions out there right now that are just, in my opinion, flat out wrong about metadata, and I worry that the judges, didn't practice in private practice at all, or didn't practice in private practice when metadata was around, and they don't understand how people use it. There are different types of metadata, some of which adds expense to a production and maybe isn't needed, but other types are critical to lawyers and save a lot of money and a lot of time in being able to search through documents. So it's important that, and I think Judge Peck's advice is good, it's important that lawyers educate a judge when they feel that there's not enough knowledge about a subject like that.
You know, to tie this back in the cooperation, when you are very educated in this area and are current, such as, you know, people on this panel, when you have a dispute over metadata and you're trying to cooperate, do you have to work that much harder to educate your adversary on why you're cooperating, even if you don't want to do what they're asking?
I would say absolutely. I mean, I just had a situation where in a discovery fight, the defendant had produced certain emails in paper copy, which was wrong. They should not have done that. It should have been produced electronically. But we were talking about maybe 50 emails. Discovery was over, and the plaintiff made a discovery sanctions and motion to compel after all depositions were over. So it was just gathering material either to torture the defendant or for trial, depending on whose side you want to take on that. But they were insisting that they wanted those emails reproduced in digital format because they wanted the metadata. And when I asked, well, what, you know, you've deposed all these witnesses, you've split the emails up to show what witness they go with, et cetera, you're done. What is it you are going to use the metadata for? Why do you need the metadata? The answer I kept getting was, well, we need the metadata and we're entitled to it. So, you know, you've got to, even in areas where you should be getting something and you should get metadata or at least certain types of metadata, if push comes to shove, you have to be educated enough to tell your adversary and eventually the judge why you need it, not just I want it because I want it.
So when does cooperating end? I mean, does it end after the meet and confer? Does it end at the end of discovery?
In my view, it never ends. You know, it's got to keep going as long as there is any discovery up to the time of trial. And
yeah, I'd agree. I'm not sure it ever has to. And there's no reason not to be civil and professional all of the time. You know, I think the kind of transparency we're talking about here maybe should pertain to the conduct of pretrial discovery. You know, I'm not sure I see how being extremely difficult about scheduling depositions or playing games and parsing words and interrogatories, you know, how that advances the ball to resolve the matters on the merits consistent with Federal Rule 1. But, you know, and your ethical obligations, you know, but that's my personal opinion. That's not necessarily the view of everybody at my firm or all of my clients, I think.
I agree with all of that. I think that mostly the types of cooperation we're talking about is going to go on at the meet and confer, but there are circumstances where, you know, I try to practice law in a way that I want to advance my client's interests, but I don't necessarily want to be aggressive to the other side if I don't have to be, if it doesn't advance my client's interests. So there's no reason not to be civil. There's no reason not to look for practical solutions when you find yourselves in the midst of a mutual problem. And if a solution is going to advance the ball for everybody, then why not try it?
You know, cooperation is easy to define as a win-win when there is a win-win. But sometimes, and actually oftentimes, parties have differing ESI burdens. Is that the hardest scenario for cooperation? And more on your side, yeah, you would often have probably a lot more in the way of ESI.
Well, when the parties have different views of proportionality or what's appropriate to spend or something like that, you know, in those circumstances, it may make sense to try to agree to do the discovery in phases if you can, right? Because you have to start somewhere, and you can agree that where you're going to stop, you'll determine later. You know, the focus shouldn't be on you know, how much can I get the other guy to spend or what's appropriate to spend. It really should be about, you know, what's necessary to prosecute or defend the case. What discovery is going to yield evidence that's going to materially impact resolving the issues in the dispute. And, you know, for example, sometimes in situations where there's a disagreement about the marginal utility of additional discovery, you can use something like sampling to determine whether it really makes sense to move forward.
Bill, you touched a little bit on this on one of your answers, which I thought was great on the privilege log. I'd sort of like to look to the future of cooperation. Where do you think we can take this? I mean, share databases? Do you see a lot more movement in Rule 502 with cooperation?
I don't know about Rule 502. I haven't seen much movement there. Shared databases, I've offered to do that probably for now almost 10 years. No one's ever taken me up on it. I am in a case right now where the defendants claim to be interested in doing it. But, you know, there's a situation where if we get involved early and get everybody on board and we can find a vendor that's acceptable to everybody, everyone can save a fortune. And part of it is convincing everyone that firewalls are going to protect privileged information, and that only the raw documents will be available to all, and convincing everybody that it's not going to be able to hack through those firewalls. But if we can do that, and I think I've actually been on panels recently where we've talked about this, I do think that that is one solution that can save a lot of money for everybody. Otherwise, I think we've got to get the word out. I just was editor in chief for Sedona of something called the Case for Cooperation that was just published, and that took a look at sort of the legal and ethical and economic background as to why cooperation is essential. And I think we need to spread the word to our fellow attorneys and to the judiciary as to what cooperation is, what it isn't, why it makes sense, what the limitations are. But I think if once we do that, and it's really a culture change, but if we can accomplish that, then I think we'll be able to move the ball forward and address the concerns that are being raised by many about the expense of discovery these days.
Yeah, it really is once parties get used to it, once lawyers get used to it, it really should be a win-win for both sides, whether equal-sized burdens, whether it's the single plaintiff employment discrimination case against the defendant company that has all the data, whatever it may be, if cooperation is done right, and that doesn't, as we've said before, doesn't mean caving or necessarily that the lawyers have to agree. They just have to be open enough that whatever they can agree on can be brought to the court for early resolution, because if it's early resolution, it will help in the cost saving. If it's something at the end of the case where the parties are asking for spoliation sanctions, that's not in anybody's best interest.
And Maura, I mean, I know with your background at Trek, in studying better search and retrieval approaches, do you see better applications for cooperation on search and retrieval as we add in, I mean, the area I work and focus in is concept searching and analytics. It's pretty complicated stuff. Sometimes it could take a day to teach people how to cooperate better, but it may be worth it given the economics involved.
Yeah, I think, or at least I hope, that we're going to see increased agreement on search protocols and a movement towards more automated review, where, for example, your privilege is protected under a 502D order or the state law equivalent. So I do, hope we'll see movement in that area. I think we also need some transparency from our vendors so that we know that the processes we're using are defensible.
Okay. Well, this has been a really neat show. I'm not sure if anyone wants to offer any last tips. I'll throw that out as a last chance to take a swing at it. Any last tips you'd like to offer on maybe places to find more information that's a good. I mean, we've mentioned a couple.
Well, I would say that there is a tremendous amount of useful information, not just the Sedona Cooperation Proclamation, but glossaries, rules, etc., on the Sedona website, which is www.thesedonaconference.org.
And I would tell people to, try this out for size and don't throw in the towel if you don't immediately see results. It's going to be a process. It's going to take some time.
And I agree with all of that. And the other thing that we didn't talk probably as much about, but it's very important, is if you're not well versed in this area, either get help or get education. There are a lot of opportunities to get CLE and pretty good CLE courses, so that at least one can get a fundamental understanding of what's going on and why it's necessary to cooperate.
You know, the fact that we didn't talk enough about it, we're still rolling here. So that's a great point to do. Judge Peck and Moore, do you want to add anything on maybe lawyers and judges taking the extra effort to educate themselves more on this? Or
Read, if you haven't yet, the ethical rule in your state on competence. And, you know, this is all the data, as Judge Peck said, is electronic these days. You've got to either know it or affiliate yourself with somebody who does.
And, you know, it is a great risk to say, okay, you know, the young first or second year associate works on a laptop computer and has used a computer through law school. They must know how to do all of this and just throw it down to that level without any instructions, without that associate's ability to get the attention of the client. It really does need an in-house knowledgeable person like Maura or going outside to a e-discovery consultant lawyer. But, you know, cooperation without competence is also a recipe for disaster. The Fannie Mae case is a perfect example where the very senior people taking cooperation to heart on both sides agreed on something, and then several months later they realized that it was taking something like 10% of Fannie Mae's entire budget just to deal with the e-discovery in this case, and they weren't anywhere near done with it. So competency and cooperation go hand in hand.
Yeah, I guess as we cooperate more and use and keep educating ourselves on the new tools, it seems to me like there's so many great ways to do this efficiently and save money. So sounds like we're making progress. I'd like to thank all three of you for being on the show. It's been real interesting. I think there's been some good consistent themes about how saving time and money can occur through cooperation. To our listeners, thank you for listening to our show. For a complete list of ESI Bytes shows, visit www.esibytes.com with a Y. And remember what we all say here, you should visit ESI Bytes to learn about e-discovery before ESI bites you back. Thank you again. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov. Have a nice day.